Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
Just a child in mama's arms.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. On today's show, the release of a 10-CD box set of Bakersfield Sound Standards and lesser-known recordings of that take-no-prisoners genre. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. But before we go to the honky-tonks and bars where musicians defied Nashville's more polished grooves and let off steam from the grueling workday, we'll look at a present-day concern for some of the Valley's hardest workers. Small farmers want a seat at the table when it comes to redefining how the state's groundwater is managed.
But first, we're going to zero in on the streets of Los Angeles to tell you about an issue that resonates here in the Valley, how to help the homeless get health care where they live. In this story from KPCC reporter Matt Tinoco and the California Dream Collaborative, doctors and healthcare professionals accompany outreach teams. It's something people across the state are doing to keep the homeless out of the ERs and improve their health.
It's a hot September morning, and I'm walking down a street in Venice, Los Angeles, with Dr. Coley King.
So here's Third and Rose.
It's a sprawling, block-long homeless encampment with maybe 30 tents under the beating late morning sun. King's one of the doctors in LA County who practices what's called street medicine.
These patients are very sick. These patients die very young. They need medical care. Let's get better medical care to them, and let's give them a better medical home that they can come into.
King works out of a nearby medical clinic that he refers all his patients to. Living on the street shaves 30 years off a person's life expectancy. The median age of death outside is about 52. The goal of street medicine is to proactively include people in a healthcare system that's otherwise inaccessible until they hitch a ride in an ambulance to the ER.
And how are you feeling now on these medications?
I love these medications because I'm not tired.
Shonda Thornton has been on several of those expensive hospital trips since she was diagnosed with congestive heart failure back in January.
How you feel when you walk a block or two?
I feel fine. I can walk all the way up to the 99 cent store and back.
She's in her 40s and has been in the hospital more than not this year.
September is the first month that I haven't.
Shonda's condition would be challenging even if she wasn't homeless. She was given a defibrillator vest and instructions to always wear it, but it malfunctions as she sweats through the summer living inside her nylon tent.
It was saying that I was having a heart attack, but I was just really perspiring a whole lot. So
she keeps the vest in its box in a shopping cart beside her tent. She doesn't have a place to charge it either.
It's like a pain in trying to keep it going.
So Dr. King works a compromise. Stay on her meds, get checked up in the clinic every now and then, and make sure her encampment neighbors know to call 911 if they see her in trouble. For Dr. King, the goal is to ensure Shonda has access to ongoing medical care that keeps her out of the ICU.
Street medicine has been a vehicle to stop the merry-go-round a little bit.
Corinne Feldman is a USC researcher who studies health outcomes for homeless patients. Reducing the merry-go-round trips in and out of the hospital by homeless people is basically the main reason there's more medical practitioners working on the street everywhere in the state than there ever has been before. LA County has almost 40 teams on any given weekday, reaching homeless people where they are.
There's a multitude of reasons why they might legitimately want to access that care, but they legitimately cannot.
Research shows that street medicine can encourage patients to more regularly seek medical attention. That can lead to reduced ER visits and greater overall trust between patients and homeless outreach providers. The reality is, though, people are going to be on the street for the foreseeable future. King says Californians need to look beyond the garbage and the tents and to really see the people out there who are struggling to survive.
The pitfall of labeling it a public health crisis, it becomes a reactionary, not in my backyard issue, where it doesn't need to be that. That's not what this is about. This is about the individuals who are sicker than the rest of us and are dying sooner than the rest of us.
That is, the squalid conditions on the street are mostly a risk for those who live in them, not so much the rest of us. As for Shonda, when it comes to getting off the street, she's actually doing better than most.
Right now, I have a voucher, I'm searching for housing.
A public housing voucher is a major step towards finding a home. The next is actually locating somewhere to use it. Her problem is just that she's been sick, though she's had several appointments to meet with property managers.
Every time I had an appointment or something, I would be in the hospital.
Which means her voucher is now close to expiring. Dr. King's job is to make sure she stays on her meds, stays out of the hospital, and actually has time to find a place to live. The street is no place to heal.
You can work on it. This is certainly a place to start working, but to fully heal out here, I don't think it's possible.
But it's the only place Shonda has to start. From Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco.
I'm Laura Satsui. You're listening to Valley Edition. We're going to stay on the topic of homelessness, but in Bakersfield. A Public Policy Institute of California statewide survey released last month found most Californians see homelessness as a top issue for the state. But how counties are choosing to tackle it differs widely. In Kern County, officials are considering jailing homeless people for misdemeanor drug offenses. To go into effect, the proposal needs funding approval from the Bakersfield City Council. Moderator Kathleen Schock talks with Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood and Deputy District Attorney Joseph Kinzel, along with Dalton Jones from Faith in the Valley and Jordan Wells from the ACLU.
So, Sheriff Youngblood, I'd like to start with you. You, along with the district attorney's office in Kern County, have really driven this proposal that involves the incarceration, potentially, of nonviolent drug offenses. How did this come about?
Well, we're going to enforce existing law. We're not making new law. But we have suffered from overcrowding in our jail. We built a new jail. We moved staff over, so it left the old jail empty. Beds are there, but no staff. So the conversation with the DA started with, I have about 600 empty beds. If we would start enforcing the law and holding people accountable, we could then have the captive audience that we had under realignment. Because under realignment, we were doing the programs and offering people assistance while they're in custody for the residential substance abuse treatment program, anger management, whatever their issue was. And then when they were released from jail, they were handed off to probation or to another counselor where they could continue their treatment. And we were having some successes. And then Prop 47 made misdemeanors out of those offenses, and we cite misdemeanors out. So that's how this all started.
So, Jordan Wells, given your work with the ACLU, what is your stance on this course of action when it comes to dealing with nonviolent drug offenses?
I guess I want to be clear from the outset that the ACLU's position on this is that putting people in jail is a cruel and it's a roundabout way to provide them with services that they need. It is far more expensive and less effective than providing community-based services and, most of all, the opportunity to live in a home. The real issue here is poverty. The real issue is access to housing. When somebody is on the street without a home, it's very difficult for them to get back on their feet. And putting them in jail just makes life that much more difficult.
Deputy DA Kinzel, please respond to this. Is this an issue of poverty and housing, or is this an issue of drug rehabilitation?
The issue, first of all, is we have criminal laws, and criminal laws still hold people accountable. There's still a crime to be under the influence of narcotics in public. It's still a crime to have drug paraphernalia for use of unlawful narcotics. It's still a crime to have heroin. Those are still crimes, and they're still punishable under state law. The problem that we're seeing is that those crimes, even when police officers and deputies catch people committing those crimes, instead of going to jail or even going to court, they're given a ticket, and they never come to court. They never have any contact with the criminal justice system aside from being given a ticket. And there's no consequences whatsoever anymore. And a lot of that is the product of realignment and supplied to Proposition 47 in our county. And so what we're having is people with drug abuse problems that are going completely unaddressed. In years past, we've had, when we had felony probation, we had Proposition 36 programs. They were essentially drug courts that provided a strong incentive for people to go through rehabilitation programs. They had probation officers that checked with them monthly. They had drug tests to make sure they were staying clean. And when things got changed, when you make those crimes misdemeanors, you have no probation officer, you have no supervision, there's no one helping at all. And on top of that, when we have the situation with our jail where people can't even be arrested, even though they're committing crimes, they're not even given an opportunity. And so you're simply taking someone with a drug problem, an addiction issue, and the criminal justice system is doing literally nothing to help them. And when you have these drug issues that are going unaddressed for years, the consequences are starting to pile up for our communities, and we need to do something about it.
So, Dalton Jones, you work with Faith in the Valley in Kern County. You're on the ground advocating on a number of issues, including the need for affordable housing and addressing the school-to-prison pipeline. Given your work on the ground, what do you think about this proposal and what could be the potential implications for the community?
From the way I'm seeing this issue, this seems like an issue more so like we're not looking at people as humans, and we've forgotten that these are our brothers and sisters, regardless of if they are housed or if they're unhoused, if they have a job, if they don't have a job, or whether or not they're drug addicted or not. These are still human beings. And to hear that they feel like it would be better to have these people go to jail as a means of rehab is not okay. I'm not seeing these people as these people are drug addicted like the 80% in the LA Times article. There's not 80% of people who are homeless that are drug addicts. That's not true. These people are literally people who have been hard on their luck and who are just trying to live. Yet we as Bakersfield are giving this narrative as if they're only good if they're producing. And if they're not producing, they should be punished. This is a narrative about punishment, and this is not okay.
So just to clarify for our listeners, it's District Attorney Cynthia Zimmer in Kern County had estimated that 80% of the homeless population is dealing with a serious addiction issue. There's been other data that has contradicted that. The most recent point in time survey put the number at roughly 50% in Kern County. But I would like to bring Sheriff Youngblood back into the conversation. What is your response to that allegation that this is not treating people in a compassionate way?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, he's not being honest with himself. Being homeless is not an excuse to commit crimes. And all we're doing is arresting people who are committing crimes. That's not an excuse because you're homeless. My question to these advocates is, why aren't you treating these people now if you have the answers? And they're not. And the reason they're not, because these people are on the streets under the influence, making irrational decisions, they're not going to go get help. You can't force them to go get help. They're committing crimes. They're victimizing our public, who we are sworn to protect. And quite frankly, the public has had enough. You know, the city of Bakersfield just hired a firm for $30,000 a month to pick up human excrement downtown. That's not okay. And if you've never seen the documentary Seattle Dying, please watch it. It'll give you a direction and a roadmap where we're headed if we don't do something constructive.
Jordan Wells, the sheriff is saying that they are committing crimes. Technically, that is the case. I believe your argument is that this is not the most appropriate course of action in terms of providing assistance to prevent people from being in these situations. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's the popular expression I think applies here, which is, when the only tool that you have in your hand is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. So if you're the sheriff or if you are the district attorney, you're going to look at every societal problem as something that can be fixed through arrests and incarceration. And what we're trying to say is that the city and the county need to be focusing on the services that these folks need in order to get back on their feet. And so just to take one concrete example to pick up on what the sheriff was just saying, there's an issue about human excrement on the ground. We have to be asking as a community, are there enough readily available public bathrooms such that people are not having to resort to defecating in public? If someone is leaving jail and they don't have a place to go and they don't have support services in order to get back on their feet, we have to be asking, why are we spending the money on extremely expensive law enforcement and incarceration when we could be spending money on getting people back on their feet through housing, through support services. I also want to challenge and reject the notion that everyone who is street homeless is a person who is resisting the resisting services. The reality is it's very difficult to get back on your feet without a home. So that's the first part. The second part is that the sheriff is painting with far too broad a brush when he says that people, as a general matter, are resistant to services. Obviously, there's always going to be somebody to hold up as an example of that, but we have plenty of more examples of people who simply cannot get back on their feet, and the answer to that is not to throw them in jail, but to give them the support and services that they need.
Dalton Jones, homelessness is an issue that is facing communities throughout California. Certainly, we are not immune to that here in the Central Valley, and it's a complex issue. A big portion of the issue is related to affordable housing. The Bakersfield Californian reported recently that multifamily residential vacancy rates have fallen in the last 2 years in Kern County from 4% to 2%. And I think that raises the question, to what extent is this an issue of lack of affordable housing? To what extent is it an issue of substance abuse issues? To what extent is it an issue of mental health issues? Give us a sense of what's really going on in the region.
In my experience, when talking to people on the ground, the things that I'm hearing people speak about is how the sheriff and the DA saying that we should just incarcerate people isn't okay. Like, incarceration isn't going to fix anything from where their point of view is. They would like more housing. They would like it if our city decided to build more like affordable housing units, but our city is worried about building and facilitating people in more jails instead of actually facilitating a space where they can actually heal. We're criminalizing instead of rehabilitating. That's what people are talking about on the ground.
Deputy DA Kinzel, you know, many listening to this are going to think that this could be a return to the quote unquote war on drugs, an approach that many feel disproportionately impacted migrant communities or people of color. What would be your response to that?
Well, first of all, it's not. The one thing I'll point out first, there was some discussion about how Mrs. Zimmer had estimated the homeless population in our town to be approximately 80% to have drug addiction issues, when the Point in Time survey revealed about 50%. You have to remember that that survey is people asking homeless individuals, are you addicted to drugs? Half of the respondents said, yes, I am. Now, when you're asking that type of a question, you can expect to have some underrepresentation because a lot of people don't like to admit that they're addicted to drugs. Some people might say, and we see this in probation reports all the time, people who are convicted of crimes, the probation department asks that question every time. Are you addicted to drugs? No, I do meth twice a day, but I don't think I have an addiction. And so what Mrs. Zimmer was referring to is what she is seeing on our streets, as well as what our officers are seeing on our streets. And so it's important to know that the statistic of 50%, that's just of people who are willing to readily admit that they have a substance abuse addiction.
I think that's a very fair point, and thank you for making it. But are you saying then that the 80% figure that DA Zimmer has raised is more anecdotal in its nature?
Well, it's more based upon experience of officers in the streets that are reporting back to, you know, of the people we see. This is the estimate that we have of how many people have substance abuse issues, because it's pretty obvious to an officer who's in the street, who has contact with these people daily, and also is aware of the crimes that they're committing, because they're issuing citations, they're seizing narcotics, they're seizing paraphernalia. Even though those crimes are going completely unaddressed by our system right now, I think that it's a fair estimate. And you were asking another issue about, is this a war on drugs? No, it's not. What it is acknowledging that with all the criminal justice changes we've had in the past 10 years, the punishment for crimes like possession of narcotics has gone down. It was a felony before, now it is a misdemeanor. The state of California still considers possession of narcotics a crime, and it still considers it punishable by up to a year in jail. That's the laws on the books. The problem is that you have a law like that still recognizes that we don't want open drug use of heroin and methamphetamine in our communities. We don't want that. We still have that law. But if we're doing nothing to enforce that law, then we're not serving our constituents. I think what Mrs. Zimmer and what Sheriff Youngblood want to do is make sure that we are enforcing the existing laws. And in doing so, we're able to provide an opportunity for people to get back on their feet. I think that the advocates on the show are concerned and want to make sure that those services are available. We're not opposed to services being available for people with drug abuse issues. The problem is that they don't get a free pass for committing crimes, and we also recognize that in order for those services to be valuable, in order to increase their ability to be effective, the criminal justice system can help by making sure that people go into these types of services, even if they might not necessarily want to. And that's something the criminal justice system can provide, and it also can provide an opportunity for people to at least get past the point of going through relapse and addiction so that they're not simply caught with narcotics and then release the same day and expecting them to make a change in their life when there's no consequence, there's no compulsion to do rehabilitation, there's nothing.
Well, I wish we had more time. There's certainly more to discuss in this issue. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I thank you all for being a part of this conversation. Thank you so much.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. The state of California is in the midst of overhauling how it manages groundwater with a new state law called the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA. Some hail it as a success in state legislation. Others say it's government overreach. But most seem to agree it could change agriculture and the economy in the San Joaquin Valley in a very big way. FM89's Carrie Klein talks about the law with Stephanie N. Agnesson, Director of Water and Natural Resources with Madera County.
SGMA has an enormous impact, potential impact on farming, and it changes everything about groundwater. So, you know, typically, if you wanted to farm, you would be able to buy some land and maybe put in a couple of wells, and you would be able to take water out and water your trees or your crops. So what SGMA does is it potentially limits how much groundwater you can take out.
And then that could, if that greatly changes or alters the way that we farm here, I mean, that could really have ripple effects into the economy and things like that, right?
Yeah. So what we see is that there are the businesses, agriculture itself, but then there are industrial businesses associated with them, like processing of nuts. And then there are restaurants, donut shops, wherever people go to socialize and to spend money. And all of those are heavily reliant on agriculture.
Right. We see those "my job depends on ag" signs all over the place.
That's right. But I mean, SGMA has some other potential effects, one of which is that more water is going to be left in the ground, which means that people who have groundwater wells that are in danger of failing, there may be less wells that fail, or they may slowly, groundwater levels may decrease, but they may not fail immediately.
That's the hope, at least.
That is the hope.
Okay, well, so then before we talk more about the substance of this law, I want to kind of touch upon the governance structure here for a minute. So while a lot of laws are top-down, you know, orders coming on high from Sacramento, this law actually requires, you know, establishing lots of local agencies to propose their own groundwater strategies. Can you talk a little bit more about how that works?
Sure. So what we've seen here is that most, if you had a water agency, they became a groundwater sustainability agency, or GSA. So there's lots of water districts that are now their own GSA. But that wasn't the only governance option. You could have had a bunch of water districts band together and become a GSA. And I worked in Santa Clarita, and that was what we had. We had a city, a county, and a bunch of water districts that became one GSA.
And what do these GSAs do?
Well, in many cases, they really just serve as the water district, but they do have powers. They can essentially levy a fee. They have the ability to restrict how much groundwater you use, and they're going to be judged. They have to turn in a large plan for how they plan to get to sustainability, and then an annual report every April on how much progress they've made.
So each one of these GSAs, they all have their own estimates for how much water they need to conserve each year. So what strategies, might they be able to come up with other than just use less water?
So we're looking at three different things here in Madera. The first is we're going to try to look at an allocation and what that might look like. So an allocation would be, for us, it would be agricultural users within the county GSA might have an amount of water that they could use each year. And that amount would gradually decrease over time. So that's one way of doing an allocation. However, I know that just using an allocation is a pretty rigid strategy, and the Public Policy Institute of California has a fair amount of research that suggests you don't want to be rigid, you want to be adaptive, and have multiple strategies. So an allocation is one option if you're critically overdrafted. Another option would be a water market where you can trade or put up a share of your native groundwater for sale. And that we have a grant for that here from the Bureau of Reclamation, where we're going to explore what that might look like with stakeholders and maybe do a pilot project. One thing that's kind of interesting is exploring what's not actually land retirement, but land resting. Like, what would it mean if we just paid a grower not to farm and had a contract for 3 to 5 years? So we haven't taken that land permanently out of production, but we've taken it temporarily out, and we can get some water savings there. And that might be a good place for someone who maybe is at the end of a career and has kids who may not want to farm and wants to just think about what next steps might look like. So there is a lot of grower support for this, for the being paid to rest or retire land. And so that's one of our first things to do next year, once we have a plan and the plan is uploaded, is to kind of figure out what that strategy might look like.
And so you're talking about the county, the Madera County GSA specifically, but every GSA might kind of have its own formula of which of these strategies it will pull from and to what amount it'll rely on each one of them.
That's right. Every GSA has its own thing going on. And so probably it's important to say that from a water management point of view, the first thing you want to do is make sure that you're bringing in all of the water that you can to your GSA. And then once you've done that, you can look at different ways of reducing demand, but you want to maximize the water supply first.
Well, very interesting. So right now is a bit of a crunch time. GSAs throughout the San Joaquin Valley are writing their GSPs. Many of them are already up for public comment. For those of us who, or for those of our listeners who might want to find their local GSA, find that GSP and submit public comment, what is the best way to do that?
So the DWR Sigma portal, which is Googleable, is probably the best way. There's an interactive map, and you can figure out where you are and what GSA provides coverage to you, and the point of contact for that GSA is also listed.
Fantastic. Stephanie Ann Agnesen, Director of Water and Natural Resources for Madera County, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Staying with Sigma, the Public Policy Institute of California has warned if these local agencies don't come up with effective groundwater strategies, huge swaths of land could be fallowed. But who chooses which land and how? In this story, FM89's Carrie Klein introduces us to small farmers who want a voice in that decision.
Dennis Hudson's rows and rows of crops are an oasis of green in the dry terrain of Allensworth, an unincorporated community in rural Tulare County.
Here is a black-eyed pea. Okay.
On 60 acres, he grows alfalfa, melons, okra, and black-eyed peas, and he has a vision for more fields bustling with jobs.
This community will forever be impoverished and viewed by the county as a hamlet, unless something happens that can create an economic base. That's what I'm trying to do.
While he picks some slender okra pods, his workers, community members he calls helpers, roll up in a golf cart.
Okay, guys.
The water's filled. It's full. The tanks are full.
Their irrigation work finished. They take off before the sun gets too high in the sky.
Okay. I'll see y'all in the morning.
Managing water is a daily task for Hudson. And as Sigma rolls out, he worries small farmers may not have the resources to adapt. That means their livelihoods and identities may be at stake.
You grow things a certain way, and then all of a sudden, you don't have access to as much water as you would like in order to grow what you grow. Now you're kind of out of sorts.
And he's wary of being pitted against bigger ag.
People will be fighting over water. That's what's going on right here in the United States right now. We may not be physically fighting, but we're fighting over water, and it's going to get worse.
Chongji Zhang shares Hudson's concerns. He's a Hmong refugee farming 40 acres in West Fresno. He grows bok choy, daikon radish, sugar snap peas, and other specialty crops.
And he has a small farmers, like, it goes back to, you know, what do we grow? And we can't really say what do we grow. It's like, well, we grow kind of everything.
But this isn't actually Zhang's land. It's a lease. On the land he owns, a well ran dry 3 years ago, and he hasn't been able to afford a new one. Those 20 acres are now fallow. Leasing is a temporary solution, and he worries about more water setbacks. Unlike bigger outfits, he doesn't have a team of accountants or lawyers keeping on top of finances and the state's ever-changing water policies.
So, in one sense, you are in a different class in terms of agricultural practice.
Sigma is supposed to be creating groundwater solutions that work for everyone. But many worry small farmers in particular aren't being engaged. Here's Dao Lohr of the Fresno-based Asian Business Institute and Resource Center. He's also been translating.
Oftentimes, it is the big farmers who has their representation and their voices heard. And there's a saying, if you're not on the table, then you're probably on the menu, right?
He's not wrong about Sigma leadership. The local agencies writing up groundwater plans called GSAs appoint leadership boards. And Jessica Rudnick, a grad student with the UC Davis Center for Environmental Policy and Behavior, says most board members are from cities and counties, as well as irrigation districts, which tend to represent larger ag interests.
At a very high level, we've basically seen that there is no representation of small farmers on most of these boards.
And yet, more than 80% of California's farmers are small farmers. Many of those are minorities. In the Valley, 1 in 10 farmers are Asian. That's why Zhang, Hudson, and others have been coming out to Sigma meetings for small farmers. One in September was put on by the UC Cooperative Extension.
So, thank you again for coming. Talk about Sigma.
Organizer Ruth Dahlquist-Willard acknowledges small farmers can be harder to reach. They have fewer resources to leave the fields and go to meetings. Those who lease land may not see policy mailings. There can be language barriers.
So the goal was really to connect the farmers with the people who are putting the plans together that are going to affect how groundwater is managed in the San Joaquin Valley.
Around 100 people showed up, including Gary Serrato. He's the executive officer of the North Kings GSA, a groundwater agency in Fresno County. He agrees representation can be a problem.
Are there larger farmers who are on boards as opposed to the smaller farmer? I would say that'd probably be a fair assessment.
In his GSA, he points out many board members are small farmers on the side, though it's not their main gig. He says his GSA is doing its best, and he does have a reputation for making an effort. He's reached out to advocacy groups representing small and minority farmers and has sent thousands of mailings to landowners. But his is just one GSA. 300 others are grappling with the same challenges, many with less success. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Stay tuned for more perspectives on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act in the coming weeks.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Buck and Bonnie Owens, Merle Haggard, Bill Woods. Their names are forever associated with the Bakersfield Sound. But what about the lesser-known artist who also belted out their stories of hardship?
Music historian and writer Scott B. Bomar has just released a 10-CD collection through Bear Family Records that fills in the blanks for even the most diehard fans. He'll speak at Cal State Bakersfield October 15th. And there's a CD launch party October 16th at the Buck Owens Crystal Palace. Valley Public Radio's Don Fisher spoke with Bomar about the collection.
9 kids and a wife. But I've been working, man, dang near all my life, and I'll keep on working. Long's my two hands are fit to use.
Okay, I'm talking with Scott Bomar, who is the creator, I guess I would say, of just an incredible 10-CD box set, The Bakersfield Sound, Country Music Capital of the West, 1940 to 1974. Not only is this a 10-CD box set, but it includes a very extensive coffee table book as part of the package. And Scott, how'd this all get started?
When I moved to California almost 20 years ago, I was already a fan of Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, but was shocked to find out how deep the country music history in California really went. And I think having grown up in Nashville and having grown up around the country music industry specifically, it was a real eye-opener to me. And I honestly just started as a fan and kind of went down the rabbit hole. And as I learned more and more and my research went deeper and deeper, it ultimately turned into a bit of an obsession, I guess, and ultimately this box set.
One of the things I wanted to ask you as part of your research, the odd thing about Bakersfield and the Bakersfield Sound is in many ways it probably shouldn't have happened there because they were just over the hill from a major recording area, Los Angeles, and it was kind of a little backwater town at the time in some respects, and yet this whole wealth of music came out of it. Talk about the evolution of that music, if you could.
Sure. And in a lot of ways, the reason that we know about the Bakersfield Sound today is because they did happen to be right over the hill from Los Angeles. Almost all of the Buck Owens and Merle Haggard recordings that are on this box set were recorded at Capitol Records down in Hollywood. And of course, other people who were part of the Bakersfield Sound, people like Tommy Collins, Ferlin Husky, Red Simpson, all signed with Capitol Records in Los Angeles there. And so there's a real tie between LA and Bakersfield that gave a platform for the music to get a wider audience. But the reason that country music, I think, really flowered and became such an important thing in Bakersfield goes all the way back to those Dust Bowl roots. And these folks who were coming out to California were oil field workers. They were farm laborers. And at the end of a hard week, they wanted to go out and blow off steam and hear music and have fun and dance. So whereas back in Nashville, for instance, where you have the Grand Ole Opry, that was music for sitting and listening to. In California, country music was for getting up and dancing. So that's why there's more of an emphasis on the drums. That's why there's more of an emphasis on the beat and the feel. And you really pick up on that difference when you compare some of the music that was coming out of Bakersfield in the 60s to some of the music that was coming out of Nashville in the same era.
Yeah, I think some of the music coming out of Nashville at the time was almost an absence of, well, electric guitars. It was more acoustic guitars and strings at the time. And like you were saying, the Bakersfield Sound, just with the Fender guitars, the Telecasters, and the sort of high level, I guess, to play over the crowds, had a totally different approach and sound.
And in a lot of ways, the birth of the Bakersfield Sound coincides with technological advances, because in the 1940s, you had these Western swing bands with, you know, sometimes 10, 12, 15, as much as 20 members, and you had horns, and you had maybe a couple of guitars, and you had all these different instruments, maybe three fiddles. And part of that was because you needed a big band to make a big sound. But as electric guitars became solid body electric guitars, as amplifiers allowed one guitar player to be heard in a small club or honky tonk, it kind of revolutionized things, because then you have these small clubs and dance halls where if somebody's booking a band for that club and they can get four or five electrified guys in there to make just as big a sound as a 15-piece Western swing band, well, that's going to save money for that club owner, and it's still going to keep the people dancing. So that had a lot to do, I think, with why the sound developed as it did. It was louder, it was rawer, and it had more energy.
What was the pivot point, the linchpin, for the sound to go from, you know, sort of the more ethnic music that came from the Midwest and the East and South in some cases to what gradually became or evidently became the Bakersfield sound?
Well, ironically, I think the reason that we even talk about the Bakersfield sound today can be traced back to one hit record that actually doesn't really sound much like what people mean when they say the Bakersfield sound. And that record was a duet record by Gene Shepherd and Ferlin Husky in 1953 called A Dear John Letter. And it was the first million-selling record by a female artist after World War II. And it was a number one country hit. I think it was a top 10 pop hit as well. But it just so happens that Ferlin Husky was living in Bakersfield at the time that that record was made. And he brought his friends down from Bakersfield, people like Fuzzy Owen and Lewis Talley and Bill Woods. And those were the guys who recorded the backing track for that song. And that same group of musicians had gone to Los Angeles previously, and they had played on other sessions. But that was the first one that was a huge hit. And Ken Nelson, who was the producer at Capitol Records in that era, wanted to duplicate that success. Hey, if these guys are playing on a hit record, let's get them to come in and play on some more records and see if those are hits. So that was kind of the gateway, I think, to that group of musicians having the opportunity to go to Capitol Records and record. And ultimately, that's when you see Buck Owens get signed to an artist deal. He came into Capitol Records as a studio guitar player.
And I guess we can't have a conversation about the Bakersfield sound without talking about the two giants of that sound, Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, who there was a lot of crossover between those two as well.
Yeah, Buck Owens and Merle Haggard emerged from the same music community in Bakersfield. Buck was a little bit older, but in the early days, those guys were using a lot of the same musicians on their records. They came up through the same clubs, you know, playing in the same community of musicians. And Merle, when asked, what is the Bakersfield sound? He basically said, well, it's the sound that Buck and I make, and it's the sound that's the end result of a whole lot of years of country music in Bakersfield. And Merle really always recognized that he and Buck came from a community. They emerged from something much larger than themselves. It wasn't just that they appeared out of thin air.
I know your package explores all these people, but they brought along a lot of secondary artists, Billy Mize, Tommy Collins, Wynn Stewart, Semi Mosley, I think, who developed the most right guitar, Clarence White. Any of those guys really stand out to you in your research?
Yeah, I think what's cool is that they brought those guys into the limelight, but in a lot of ways, many of those guys predated Buck and Merle. Buck's first Capitol Records session that he ever played as a studio musician was with Tommy Collins. And after Buck became really well known, he took Tommy Collins on tour with him and recorded an entire album of Tommy Collins songs. So kind of the guys that Buck and Merle looked up to and even worked for on their way up, once they made it, they made sure to highlight those people and to recognize them. Bill Woods was another one who was kind of the godfather of the local music scene in Bakersfield. And Red Simpson wound up writing a song called Bill Woods from Bakersfield that Merle recorded.
We also need to talk about, I think, because it wasn't just a male-oriented music. There were women involved, Bonnie Owens and Jan Howard and a lot of others who were able to succeed as artists in that Bakersfield area.
At that time, country music usually had one female on a concert, on a package show, which they always referred to as the girl singer. And Bakersfield was no different in that regard, but you had people like Kay Adams and later Susan Ray, and definitely Bonnie Owens, who was married to Buck at one point and later married to Merle. But aside from the fact that she was married to the two biggest stars of the Bakersfield Sound, was an incredible artist in her own right, and probably would have been a bigger star had she not essentially dedicated her career to Merle. And really, when you look at Buck Owens, his lead guitar player, Don Rich, was such an integral part of his sound. I don't know if Buck would have had the kind of career that he had without Don Rich. And I would say that Bonnie Owens really served that same role for Merle, that Bonnie was really Merle's right hand and harmony singer. And Merle always credited her with writing down a lot of lyrics that he would have otherwise forgotten that he wrote. And so in a way, it's interesting to imagine what would have happened had Bonnie not dedicated her career essentially to supporting Merle. And if she hadn't, she might have become a bigger star and we might not know the name Merle Haggard today. So she was a very important figure and universally revered on the Bakersfield scene.
And I guess radio and television played a part in this as well. I know there were television shows devoted to the music. I think cousin Herb Henson had one in particular, and there were probably others I'm not thinking of, but there was a lot of support from that side of things too.
That's right. You had the Jimmy Thomason show, which went on the air about the same time as Cousin Herb Henson's show in 1953. And Cousin Herb was the big daddy of Bakersfield television. And his show could be seen, you know, for miles around, all the way up in Fresno. And some folks were even able to get it down in some parts of northern Los Angeles County. And he had every big country star who came through town appeared on his show in the afternoon and then would go play at the Blackboard Honky Tonk that evening. And so Herb really introduced country music to folks in Bakersfield who maybe didn't come from Oklahoma or Arkansas or Texas, people who had maybe looked down on country music previously or saw it as something that was non-cultured or beneath them. And then here you have Cousin Herb Henson on television every weekday afternoon, who's this friendly, well-spoken, very the kind of guy that's made for television and did great on-air advertising and was extremely likable, a fantastic salesman. And he really did a lot for helping country music in Bakersfield be accepted by those who didn't come to Bakersfield and bring that country music with them. And I think that's always been a part of country music's story, is finding acceptance and being able to make inroads within communities that maybe are outside of country's traditions.
Before we part ways here, I think we need to talk a little bit about Ken Nelson as well. He certainly played a big part in all this.
Ken Nelson was the producer at Capitol Records who signed Buck Owens, signed Merle Haggard, Red Simpson, essentially every quote-unquote big name that came out of Bakersfield, with the exception of Billy Mize, was a Capitol Records artist. So Ken Nelson gave them that platform to get their records out to the wider world. And in fact, it was Ken Nelson who came up with the term Bakersfield Sound, which originally was just a way of saying, hey, I want to get those guys who live up in Bakersfield to come down and play on some records as backup musicians. But that name actually took off and kind of stuck. And so that was the label that got put on the musicians who lived in Bakersfield. And, you know, in some ways, I think what people call the Bakersfield sound is even bigger. It's kind of a California sound with artists like Wynn Stewart and others who Ken Nelson brought to Capitol Records as well. So, you know, I think there would have been a thriving local country music scene in Bakersfield no matter what, but we might not know about it had it not been for Ken Nelson's efforts to bring it to the rest of the world.
You've obviously spent a lot of time with this music, putting this package together. Are there certain songs that stand out to you as ones that are very memorable?
Honestly, the original lineup was about 600 tracks, and we had to scale it down just to keep the thing manageable. I love this music so much, but I think some of my absolute favorites are Who Will Buy the Wine by Billy Mize, which was released on Decca Records in the mid-50s. Of course, the Buck and Merle stuff is classic. Bill Wood's recording of Truck Driving Man, I've always loved. But one of my absolute favorites on the box set is by Johnny Barnett, who was the band leader at a club called The Lucky Spot. And Johnny was at The Lucky Spot for years and years and years, and he was a local star, but he only ever recorded one record. It was a single on Tally Records based in Bakersfield, and the song Second Fiddle that he recorded is the very first song that was ever commercially released written by Merle Haggard. And at the time, Merle Haggard was a young bass player playing in Johnny Barnett's band. But I think what I love so much about that record is it sounds incredible, but it also represents guys like Johnny Barnett who were so important on the local scene and never became household names. They never became widely known, but they were making music that is just indisputably great. And so I love that record for what it represents and just for being a great sounding record.
It's been good talking to you, Scott. Thank you for being the person that really put this all together and bringing it to the fore as one complete package.
Thank you, Don. I sure appreciate it.
This weekend, let's take a look at Fresno Museums. Arte Americas is debuting an exhibit on fashion called Katrinas and Couture, while the Fresno Art Museum is featuring California-based creators, two of whom reside in Fresno. Just added to the Fresno Art Museum's permanent collection is a piece from Fresno native Darren Waterston. He now lives and works from New York City, but got his early art education at the museum. Waterston and I recently spoke in the museum courtyard about his paintings and where the Central Valley fits among his work.
When you were in high school and when you were coming to the Fresno Art Museum and sort of being more exposed to art and this kind of one space where it's just everywhere, did you imagine that your art would be here?
That it would become... No. I mean, I never really imagined I would have the career I did or that I do. It's still an extraordinary thing to be a living artist, that's my livelihood, and my professional life is what it is through just my art. It's an incredible honor, and I just never have taken it for granted. It's a really incredible thing.
Do you feel like there are elements of the Central Valley or Fresno in any of your art?
Not that I can directly identify with. I mean, certainly my long-standing interest in just the landscape and being able to study the change of light or the way in which San Joaquin Valley has such a particularity around just the sky and refraction, and it has its own color palette that's so particular. And so I think that maybe living here, I was always very observational around what made this particular place so specifically unique, and so maybe just learning how to look and see is kind of what came out of being here, but nothing, not specific.
What's the painting called that you have here?
The painting is called Last Days, Gabriel, and it is a abstracted vision of the angel Gabriel, and it came out of a study of looking at sort of utopian visions and apocalyptic visions, and it's a very sort of epic painting in a certain way, and about the ideas of last days.
How would you describe your piece to a listener?
I work between abstraction and representation in my paintings, and so there will always be something that feels that it invites you into the painting, and then there's often things that leave you more with questions than they do answers, and so there's an ambiguity that's always very much woven into the paintings. So I want the viewer to feel, challenged by what they're looking at, and also find both beauty and discomfort, both.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team. Laura Sitsui, Carrie Klein,
Alice Daniel, and Monica Velez. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Laura Sitsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.